This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, October 16th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. The Hobby Lobby decision has been misunderstood and purposefully mischaracterized. Ed Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, commented on the ruling and its critics at the Cato Institute's Constitution Day event held last month.
There's been lots of confused public commentary about this case. That confusion, oddly enough, has continued beyond the ruling, and even more oddly, part of it has been from Justice Ginsburg herself, who you think ought to know better. But among other things, she's been saying this past summer that the court's ruling was a constitutional ruling resting on the Free Exercise Clause, when, as I'll explain, it was clearly entirely a statutory ruling based on the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. She also misstated the basis of her own dissent, and I'll get to that in a bit. So what I'm going to do is give some background, then talk through the four main issues that the court addressed, and conclude with some remarks about the aftermath of Hobby Lobby. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was enacted in 1993. It was Congress's response to the court's 1990 decision, Employment Division v. Smith. In that case, the court ruled that neutral, generally applicable laws don't violate the Free Exercise Clause. That ruling was widely regarded as reducing the free exercise protections that had previously existed under cases like Sherbert v. Verner. And the express aim of RFRA in 1993 was to restore, as a matter of federal statutory law, the protections that existed pre-Smith under the Free Exercise Clause. RFRA is at heart a very simple statute. It has a threshold inquiry and then a strict scrutiny standard. The threshold inquiry looks to whether the government has substantially burdened a person's exercise of religion. If the answer to that question is yes, you proceed to the strict scrutiny inquiry, which asks whether the government has demonstrated, burden clearly on the government, that application of the burden to the person is in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling governmental interest. The HHS mandate, as I think most of you know, is a regulatory implementation of Obamacare. Obamacare delegated to HHS the authority to specify preventive services that group health plans must cover and that they must cover without any cost-sharing requirement. The idea is that there are certain services that you don't want to have any disincentive at the point of decision. So yes, there's payment up front, same way there is, say, on all-you-can-eat buffet. But when it comes to the decision you're making and whether you want X, Y, or Z for a whole range of preventive services, the idea is not even to have a $5 copay. You want to have that decision unencumbered by any financial disincentive. Under the rule adopted by the administration, those preventive services include, for women, all FDA-approved contraceptives, including those drugs like Ella and Plan B, and devices like the copper IUD that might sometimes operate to kill the early human embryo by preventing implantation in the womb. The rule applies to non-grandfathered group health plans. And very briefly, there's a long, tortuous history of the mandate, but you ended up with an exemption for a narrow category of religious employers. You ended up with a so-called accommodation for religious nonprofits. That accommodation was designed to address the religious liberty interest of these religious nonprofits by making it so they weren't paying for, or suppose they weren't really involved in the provision of objected to drugs and services. And as for the for-profit employers who don't operate grandfathered plans, the mandate is to operate directly against them. The administration has made clear that it gave no consideration at all to how the Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies to the HHS mandate. Intense litigation ensued. I'm going to focus on the litigation brought by the for-profit entities. There's a separate wave of litigation that was somewhat deferred against the accommodation, and you're hearing a lot about that now. Basically, a whole set of Catholic and non-Catholic plaintiffs, basically owners of closely held for-profit corporations and the corporate entities themselves, brought suit against the HHS mandate in courts across the country, claiming as the core of their argument that this was a violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Typically, the Catholic plaintiffs challenged the contraceptive requirement in its totality that is applied to a whole range of contraceptives. Typically, non-Catholic plaintiffs challenged those drugs and devices that might operate to kill the early embryo. There's a whole dispute that's, I think, on the left about whether it's ever the case that these drugs and devices can operate that way. The FDA says they can. The Obama administration says they can. And even the brief filed by the obstetrician associations acknowledge that it certainly can in the case of copper IUD, and that the science is far from conclusive on the other drugs. Let me briefly outline who Hobby Lobby is, because a central question in the case, the one that got most attention, is can this corporate entity engage in an exercise of religion? Hobby Lobby is a national chain of more than 500 arts and crafts stores with more than 13,000 full-time employees. It's a closely held family business. Its official statement of purpose says it aims to honor the Lord in all we do by operating the company in a manner consistent with biblical principles. Implementing that statement of purpose, it's closed on Sundays, obviously a great financial cost. It regularly runs newspaper ads around Christmas and Easter that are intensely evangelistic. Gives employers access to chaplains, spiritual counseling, and religiously themed financial courses. Gives millions of dollars each year to ministries. Doesn't allow its trucks to backhaul beer. And does a whole set of activities that demonstrate its commitment, its owner's commitment to its religious principles. The same family, the Green family, also owns a chain of a Christian bookstores, Mardell. Often you hear talk about secular for-profit businesses, but one of the plaintiffs in this case was a Christian bookstore, which wouldn't really seem to be a classic example of a secular business. The company has faced massive fines for refusing to comply with the mandate. If they continue to operate these group health plans, Hobby Lobby, for example, would face a fine of nearly $475 million a year. If they chose instead to drop health coverage in addition to the penalties that suffer in recruiting employees, that face a penalty of some $26 million a year for not providing health coverage. The court in Hobby Lobby divided 5-4, the four conservatives and Justice Kennedy in the majority, the four liberals in dissent. Basically, there are four issues up for grabs. First issue is, Hobby Lobby capable of engaging in an exercise of religion? Is its objection to these to provision of these objected to drugs an exercise of religion? On that question, the court divided 5-2, with only Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor taking the position that closely held corporations were not persons capable of engaging in an exercise of religion under RFRA. Second issue, does the mandate impose a substantial burden on employers? Is this multi-million dollar fine a substantial burden? Court unbelievably divided 5-4 on that. Discuss that more in detail in a bit. Third question, when you get now past the threshold inquiry to the strict scrutiny test, does the HHS mandate advance a compelling governmental interest? On that question, the majority said, we're not going to decide this. There are arguments both ways. We don't need to decide this. We'll assume arguendo that such an interest exists. Justice Ginsburg argued at length that it does. And then on the fourth issue, has the government shown that the HHS mandate is the least restrictive means of advancing the assumed governmental interest? On that point, again, the court divided 5-4, with Justice Alito pointing out that the accommodation that the administration has offered to religious nonprofits is, by the administration's own representations, a less restrictive means. That therefore defeats the government's argument that it has somehow shown that the mandate, full-fledged mandate, is the least restrictive means. Let's look in some more detail at these. Again, first is, you know, can a corporate entity be a person engaged in exercise of religion? Justice Alito spells out, for starters, the term person in RFRA plainly includes corporations. The Obama administration admits as much when it says that nonprofit corporations are persons. He explains that the corporate form, therefore, can't explain the exclusion. That is, if nonprofit corporations can engage in the exercise of religion, how is it that for-profit corporations can't? He shows further that the profit-making objective has never excluded entities from having religious protections. A classic example here, I think, is take a kosher deli. Under the dissenter's view, if that deli were obligated to sell non-kosher meat, somehow it might have a religious liberty claim if it's unincorporated, but it wouldn't have one if it's incorporated. You often heard from the left that the assertion corporations can't pray, which of course is true, to which we responded in our brief, well, corporations can't dance, can't do a lot of other things that are protected by the First Amendment. That doesn't mean that the New York Times is deprived, say, of First Amendment protection as a corporate entity when it does engage in protected those First Amendment activities that it can engage in. Curiously, this past summer, Justice Ginsburg said that her Hobby Lobby dissent, quote, really didn't turn on the difference between a corporation and a sole proprietorship. Funny, if you read it, she's saying corporations can't have any rights in the RFRA, can't engage in exercises of religion, and leaving open the possibility that proprietorships could. I think what you see is her real hostility is to RFRA and to the long tradition in this country that recognizes that religious liberty extends to how people carry out business. Let's see, I'm told I'm running a little short on time. Let me jump quickly to the substantial burden question. Again, Alito's analysis was simple. Massive fines for noncompliance, of course, this is a substantial burden. I think it was in Wisconsin v. Yoder, where there's a $5 penalty on fathers who refuse to send their kids to high school, and that was a substantial burden. Ginsburg instead says that somehow the connection between the family's religious objections and the contraceptive coverage requirement is too attenuated to rank as substantial, that the linkage has been, quote, interrupted by independent decision makers. Well, as Justice Alito spells out, she's really smuggling into the substantial burden inquiry a very different question, whether the plaintiff's views of what constitute improper moral complicity are acceptable. That's a question the court has made clear that the federal courts have no business addressing. There's a precedent called Thomas v. Review Board, which Justice Ginsburg made no attempt to confront, much less distinguish, which involved a fellow who objected to making turrets for tanks. And his claim was upheld, even though you could say that he objected to war, but it was a series of independent decisions that would put the turret that he was making on the tanks. They would put the tanks that the turrets were put on in the military. They would put those tanks then in warfare that would then use them in warfare. And the court made quite clear that it wasn't the court's business to decide what is and is not acceptable, an acceptable view of improper moral complicity. On the least restrictive means, the one point I want to emphasize here, because I think it's been confused a lot in the public, is that there is nothing in the court's approach, that is to say that this accommodation offered the religious nonprofits as a less restrictive means. There's nothing in that analysis that requires that the accommodation itself be deemed to satisfy RFRA. Indeed, you saw the same analysis by the Chief Justice in the abortion, McClellan v. Coakley, the abortion case, was decided 3 days before, abortion protest case. There he identified a number of less restrictive alternatives that the state legislature might have adopted while making clear that it wasn't endorsing the constitutionality of any of those alternatives. So it's enough under RFRA to say, government, you haven't shown that this is the least restrictive alternative because instead of doing A, you could do B. And when someone challenges B, they might be able to show you could have done C. And when you challenge C, you might be able to show you could have done D. But we don't have to show that B somehow is satisfactory. It makes no sense to put that burden on the plaintiff challenging the government action. Let me finish up by observing that there's a Wheaton College order that quickly followed on the tails of the Hobby Lobby ruling. There, the dissenters, without Breyer, Justice Breyer actually, claim that the majority was acting contrary to what it did in Hobby Lobby. Actually, all that the court said in the Wheaton College order is this accommodation, we're giving you relief from this accommodation, Wheaton College. Wheaton College is a religious nonprofit. And there's nothing in there that was inconsistent with the treatment that it gave the mandate. Finally, I'll mention Professor Richard Epstein has an essay in the book that's been handed out to you on Hobby Lobby. As always with Professor Epstein, it's provocative and interesting. I will say that I think it's wrong on almost every major point, as well as some minor ones. Among other things, I think it's grossly unfair of Professor Epstein to fault Justice Alito for not assuming that he has four colleagues who are Richard Epstein. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Ed Whalen is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. You can get your copy of Cato's Supreme Court Review at our website, cato.org.